On this episode of the InsurTech Geek Podcast, talking about leading transformation with a startup mindset with David Monklow from MSIG North America. The InsurTech Geek Podcast, powered by JB Knowledge, is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. We'll be interviewing guests and doing deep dives into specific tech we see changing the industry. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech, so enjoy the ride and geek out. This episode of the InsurTech Geek Podcast is brought to you by JB Knowledge. JB Knowledge specializes in outsourced software development solutions for property and casualty insurance technology. Check out our services at jbknowledge.com. And we are back with another great episode of the InsurTech Geek Podcast. With me, my illustrious co-host, the most interesting man in insurance, author of End of Insurance as We Know It, Rob Galbraith. How's it going, Rob?
Hey, it's going well, James. How about yourself?
Outstanding. Loving the 70-degree Texas wintertime. It's nice outside, enjoying the fine weather, and certainly looking forward to a little bit more downtime. Had a little downtime at Thanksgiving. We'll have a little more downtime at Christmas. And then off to the races for 2024. Hard to believe 23 is already coming to a close. And with us, our illustrious guest, David Monklow. David, how are you doing?
I'm great, James. How are you?
I'm great. David, where are you joining us from today?
I'm up in Brewster, New York, about an hour and a half north of New York City.
Okay, how do they say that? Brewster, New York?
Brewster.
Brewster, New York, yeah. So you said how far from New York City is it?
About an hour and a half.
Like north towards the Catskills?
Yeah, well, no, it's on the east side of the river. It's my wife's family's from the Hudson Valley, so we moved back to be near them.
How far from Kingston?
Probably about 40 minutes if you can get across the river on one of the bridges. Otherwise, it's a long swim.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. I've spent a little bit of time up there in that part of New York and enjoyed it thoroughly. Really pretty part of the state. Glad
it's
you're joining
beautiful
us today.
Here.
Yeah, beautiful. It's really pretty. Plus, you got some good skiing not too far from you, so yep. It's a lot of fun. So let's jump straight in, David. First, we're going to talk about all kinds of things, but we want to start by talking about you and your career. You went to college in Canada, but you actually grew up on an island.
Is that right? I grew up in Bermuda, and I'm one of those sort of oddballs in the sense that I left the island and still pursued an insurance career. Although I, like probably most people, I fell into my insurance career. I think that's how we all get into it. No one goes to college to be in the insurance industry, but
not many.
Fell into mine.
Yeah, not many people do. So tell me, like, what did your parents, was your dad in insurance, mom in insurance? Like, who was in insurance? How did it lead you growing up on Bermuda?
Yeah, quite literally, when I got started, and this unfortunately is going to date me a little bit, there wasn't much of an insurance industry on the island. I was the 30th employee of ACE. And I got my job, ironically, because I was in the banking business, and they started a product that needed effectively a financial analyst. And I was good friends with the younger brother of the then CFO, and I became employee number 30. Brian Dupreau was employee number 31, and that started my career. And back then, there were probably maybe 200 people on the island doing insurance, and that was about it.
Wow, that's a very different Bermuda than we know now.
Oh, very different, very different. But it's what's great, James, is I think having had the luxury of being born there and being there during what was the next 15 years of a lot of things going on, I saw and learned a lot and was involved, luckily enough, in a lot of things that shaped my career. So I think I count myself lucky. And I sort of am a little bit of a unicorn in the industry, having sort of been in what was a petri dish, really, if you think about it, right, for so much development. And back then, we talked about innovation because we formed a cat-focused reinsurance company, you know, long before innovation was technology-driven, right? It was,
yep.
It was structure-driven, market structure-driven. So it was pretty cool.
What led to Bermuda being an insurance mecca for the world?
Great question, right? And if you read all the newspapers and the history articles, it's around the common law, the British common law being giving everybody contract certainty. It was sort of an hour and a half away from New York. so enough people could get to Bermuda quickly and be in a British domicile place that had a zero tax environment. I think there was a little bit of, if you will, luck in that a couple of critical people at the start of the birth of Bermuda's industry knew Bermuda anyway. You might remember a guy named Ernie Stemple who worked for, you know, worked for Hank Greenberg. He had a history of being on the island for AIG's overseas operations. I went to school with his son long before AIG and its affiliates sort of became, big players on the island. So it was a little bit of a, you know, the typical stuff, right? It was contract certainty. It was a nice place to do business. People could get on a plane and go there, and, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. Tax structures always matter, but proximity matters too. And it sounds
And it's a people business, right? I mean, it's, you want to be in front of the people that you do business with.
Yeah. When you have a great tax structure and you've got a, taxes matter, but, you know, being an hour and a half from New York is also a huge win. You know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to be that close. So at what point did you move back from the island onto the mainland?
Well, it was sort of interesting, and this started my unicorn career. At the time at Ace, we were toying with the idea of doing more cat reinsurance. And it just so happened that year, a gentleman from Goldman Sachs walked in the door of our offices, and he and another gentleman were the only two guys in Goldman that were doing interesting things in insurance. And he came in and he pitched us on the idea of transferring wind risk into the capital markets. And of course, probably like everybody else in the world, we laughed at him. But my boss said, no, this is an interesting idea. Let's try and do this. And the young guy in the corner, what's your name? David Mocklow? You work on this project and see if you can make it work. So I spent a year, this is really dating me, on trying to do what would have been the very, very first cat bond. If you go back and look at Georgetown Re, you'll know what year I'm referring to. But we never got it done because back then there was no technology to transfer wind risk or earthquake risk or any risk into the capital markets. It didn't exist. Now you can stamp out an ILS private deal in about 12 minutes. And my wife was American. We were thinking about getting back to the States. And my buddy at Goldman said, why don't you come work for me? You're a smart guy. You get this right away. I want to build this as a real business at Goldman. And so I said, yeah, I'll come work for you. And of course, unfortunately for me, he resigned and went to work for Aon. And my wife said, well, let's go to Chicago. So I ended up in Chicago working with him as part of a team to start Aon Capital Markets. And that started my journey, if you will, down a very different path than anything I ever imagined and anybody else. And I remember Chris McGee and I were the first co-presidents of what was then the Bond Market Association's ILS committee. And, you know, Rob, we were just in Vegas, right? 10,000 people going to an ITC conference. We had the very first ILS conference in Boca Raton, Florida, and we had 65 people there because there was nobody in the ILS marketplace back then. And now everybody and his dog has got an ILS play somewhere, shape, or form, right?
And by ILS, you mean insurance-linked.
Insurance-linked securities. We didn't call them that then back then. We called them cat bonds, right? That's what they were called.
Yeah, these are financial instruments that let investors speculate on events.
So exactly.
Cats, hurricanes, earthquakes, pandemics. It allows for large amounts of investor capital to place bets. So it provided what necessary capital for the size of the catastrophes, right?
Yeah, and it's become, if you will, one of the biggest innovations in our marketplace, and one would argue one of the biggest disruptors in the marketplace. And it sort of signaled, if you will, what I think of as the next obvious set of innovation in the marketplace, right? We're going to talk a lot about innovation on this podcast, but to me, that was the first real big one, right? It was the start of a catastrophe specialty marketplace where we suddenly had cat reinsurers and ILS investors, and we had specialists in the food chain producing risk and selling risk. And, it, you know, all of a sudden, instead of having a client, a broker, an insurer, and maybe a global reinsurer like Munich Re, we suddenly added three more mouths in the food chain, and we became more of a specialist marketplace. And that, to me, was the very first time the industry started to resemble more of a, I don't know, maybe more of a financial marketplace rather than just a buyer and a seller of a risk.
Yeah.
And that was cool, but it certainly was the start of a pretty cool adventure for me across the insurance and financial markets.
Well, for sure. I mean, you're at the very tip of the spear, both with Bermuda and with insurance linked securities. I mean, that's
it was pretty cool, right? I got to either be very close or involved in a bunch of new IPOs and startups in Bermuda. I left Aon to join a more traditional investment bank doing capital raising, M&A, advisory work. I got involved in some interesting IPOs. One of the ones that I think has sort of led me to being, again, a little bit more of a unicorn was I got involved in one startup as an advisor and one business as a capital raiser. One of the advisory roles was for a new total return reinsurer. And I tell this story somewhat tongue-in-cheekly, but I don't think I thought about it at the time. We went to AM Best to do the pitch book on the new company. And Rob, you'll love this. We had a 60-page presentation, and on page 59, titled under Other Matters, third row down, not even the first row of the third of the other matters, was we're going to outsource our claims to Sedgwick or York. And at the moment, I hadn't thought about it, but I'm just sitting there thinking, we just spent 60 pages talking about a $1 billion startup and all the amazing things we'll do to get clients, underwrite business, price risk. And then we left.
One sentence on claims.
One sentence to how we're going to spend 70 cents out of every dollar. And then I did an advisory role for a capital raise for a company that was in the legacy space, the runoff space, where a buyer company would buy old claims from insurance companies and try to monetize them, try to drive profit from those companies. And I got to be very close friends with the management team, including the CFO. And I sat there and I spent a year inside of their business understanding how they could make money on a core activity of the rest of the industry who struggled to make money. And I remembered my AM Best pitch book and thinking, yeah, that's why this company is so successful, because everybody else relegates claims to effectively one line, right? Which is, we'll outsource it to someone else. And that sort of was another critical phase of my journey, if you will, my unicorn phase. I went from being a finance guy focused on raising money, developing a Wall Street following and getting close to the Wall Street community, to suddenly seeing inside the belly of the companies and going, wow, there are some things that they don't do very well. We should try to figure out how to do it better. And of course, back then, the better wasn't a technology solution, right? It was, you know, it was blocking and tackling. And then I did something that probably every investment banker does after they leave the finance world, right? I went and started a TPA.
You saw that one sentence about handling claims, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to go do that.
Well, it was interesting because I actually met a family that had just made a lot of money selling their insurance company, and a mutual friend introduced me to him, and I gave him this little journey I had been on, and they sat there and said, you're absolutely right. We're really, really good at claims. And they had been wildly good at claims, which is why their business was worth so much money. Uh-huh. And we sat there and said, we can make a lot of money doing this better than everybody else in the industry. And like a lot of people, you know, you have grand plans, and sometimes the scale, you don't appreciate the scale. And one of the things that we didn't do is I don't think we did a good job of assessing how technology could really help. And in the claims world, technology has been a four-letter word, right? It has not been something that everybody has embraced. They've left it behind. So when I go and talk about insurance, oftentimes I talk about what I think is an underserved part of our industry where no one's, well, I shouldn't say that. Rob, I know, talks about this, but I think the claims area is an area that the industry doesn't do a good job thinking about technology.
Yeah, it's funny when we talk to new tech-centric MGAs or insurtechs, I'm like, well, talk to me about claims. Oh, we use a TPA for that.
Yeah, like, they just, it's a throwaway sentence, right?
I know. I'm like, well, I work for the TPAs, and I know what actually goes on behind the scenes when they work for these tech-forward MGAs, and there's nothing special or no secret sauce that's going into it at these. You know, the major TPAs are just doing their best to keep up with hiring demands and, you know, claim adjuster claim counts. I mean, there's a lot to adjusting claims properly.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of strategy there that hinges on what kind of policies you write, too, and a lot of data that can feed back.
And we're doing that at a time where it's getting harder to do that, right? The claims, our claims infrastructure, the people are older than they are in other parts of our industry. They've got a lot of experience. They're retiring. There's a lot of institutional knowledge we're going to lose. It's not being replaced by smart technology that embeds 30 years of experience into workflow or data schema or how you deal with in a courtroom with a claim. It's really a crisis in my mind, and one that, as we think about it in Mitsui, we're really focused on.
And let's wrap this first question with this little sub question: who is Mitsui and what do they do?
Yeah, Mitsui Sumitomo is the seventh largest global insurance company, and it's the one I always laugh about, which no one in the States has ever heard of, right? When I sort of went and did my due diligence on the company, I literally couldn't find them. They didn't even show up in the top 400 ranks of American insurance companies. And it always struck me as odd, right? Because they are a global brand. They are the largest insurer in Japan. They've got a 300-year history of business, which is incredible. They've got a fairly large presence in Lloyd's through the Amlin syndicate. And they got a presence in Asia, but they didn't really have a presence in the States. And so my role is to help them build what we hope will be a world-class specialty insurance presence in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Rob?
Yeah, David, so many different ways I could take this conversation, but just kind of following up, like from a Mitsui standpoint, what are some of the specific challenges that you face in North America? You know, you talked about trying to establish a meaningful presence. So, you know, what are some of those things that you're really focused on? And then how does North America differ from Asia and those other regions where Mitsui is such a dominant player?
Yeah, Rob, you hit on something that I think is a challenge that's maybe a little bit different for us than it is for a lot of other startups, right? We have this incredible financial strength. We have this amazing history of commitment, staying committed to markets. When you walk in the door and you talk about that to clients, that matters, right? They want to know that you're in a market, you're going to stay, you're not going to come in and out and leave and abandon them when things get tough. And that's critical. And our financial strength helps us a great deal. But like any newcomer, right, we have typical newcomer challenges. We've got to get our brand out there. We've got to let people know what our products are. We've got to develop the kind of personnel skills, interpersonal relationships that you need in the insurance industry, right? It's all done people to people. There are embedded relationships that sometimes are hard to dislodge, and we've got to convince people our rating, our products, our service all matter and are important. And that's typical. But we also have, and I don't think of these as challenges, but we have other things we have to deal with. And you mentioned them before, right? Which is partly cultural, right? The U.S. market is really unique. And the Japanese, some Japanese companies have been here in size for a long time. Tokio Marine's been in the States for a long time, and they've thought through all those issues and they've gotten comfortable. But for Mitsui, a lot of what the American marketplace is it's new. And they didn't, you know, the Japanese marketplace, a lot of captive agents, right? Your distribution model is your own internal agents. In the States, you've got big brokers you have to partner with, Aon Marsh and the Willis on the retail side, Amwin, CRC, RPG on the wholesale side. And you have to get comfortable that those partners are important, and you have to be able to make them interested in doing business with you. And that's a different way of doing business than the Japanese are used to. Of course, another big difference is we have a very bifurcated market, right? We have an admitted world and we have a non-admitted world, and how you navigate those worlds are very different. The market here that's also very different is we rely increasingly on MGAs and third-party underwriters, right? 10 years ago, what was it? $5 billion of written premium in the MGA world, it's the fastest growing sector. So you have to get used to giving the pen to someone else and hoping they do a good job for you. That's a very different model, unless it's a captive agent who you could fire on the spot because they do a bad job. But here's the biggest issue, and it comes back to what we talked about before, and I think it's the underappreciated issue. How you do claims and how you manage litigation in the States is so much harder and different. And it really should, it doesn't in many companies, but it should really be at the forefront of every strategic decision you make about how you build and run your company, your people, your products, everything. And that's very different, right? The Japanese don't typically have to work in an environment that's highly litigious, where courts matter, right? So it, all those things are important combinations and they're important factors. And they're all things we have to work with our Japanese colleagues to get them to understand, because we have to tell them, what are we building that will mitigate those challenges that we face in our business, right? How do we deal with claims? How do we deal with these third-party underwriters? Those are all things we have to teach them and get them comfortable with.
Yeah, excellent point. And certainly on this show, it seems to be the MGA show.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. Are there just five people that are actually carrying paper? I mean, that's sometimes you wonder, like who's actually at risk? Of course, MGAs can buy into the risk too. So, I mean, we're seeing a lot of MGAs that start as like pure play MGAs and they start buying risk as well. So, I mean, you know, you see them edge into that space as they, you know, aggregate more profit. They start taking on some of the risk too.
And the good ones, the good ones in the future who have a real edge, data being one, for example, they should take risk, right? I mean, that's where the biggest absolute value is, right?
Yeah, that's where the money can really be delivered. That's a great segue to talking about technology.
Yeah.
What I like to talk about practical technology. Like we could talk about AI and what it's going to do. And look, I used large language models and ChatGPT for an hour today. I applied to be able to use Grok. I mean, like they're interesting and captivating and fun to use and provide a lot of value. Don't get me wrong, but I've been building insurance software for 20 years. You know, for carriers, TPAs, MGAs, brokers. Most of the requests are very meat and potatoes. Like most companies I see, big ones, still use the hell out of Microsoft Excel and are still trying to get off of Excel for quoting or binding or dealing with reporting, claim data reporting. I mean, so give me an idea of like what you think the top innovations have been so far and what tech you're most excited about.
Well, first off, James, you're actually not talking to David Maklow. You're talking to ChatGPT, and
you're just a synth of a human.
Exactly. You know, I'm like you. I get a lot of people pitch me on a lot of stuff, right? I hear it all the time. And I'm constantly blown away by the fact that I believe there's a massive amount of low-hanging fruit in doing some basic things well, right? And when I think about basic technology, I sort of think about our industry at its two bookends, how we write premium and how we manage claims. Everything else in the middle is sort of a workflow, right? It takes you from the premium that you wrote to when you've closed the account, either by booking a profit or paying a claim. And so I think about the bookends. Historically, the underwriters have all been doing stuff sort of on their yellow pads and waiting for the brokers to bring the business to them. And so it's not an efficient process, nor is it one where we capture value. And what do I mean by that? Well, we get lots of submissions and we spend a lot of time trying to read through them and then going, all right, these are the three I'm going to underwrite. And so we've wasted time sort of pulling all that information together to start thinking about it. And then we've lost all the data for the other stuff. So to me, one of the big innovations, which I think is very, very powerful, and I see a lot of companies doing this, and it was a core foundation for how we started attacking the build of our company, was we said, what's the thing that will give us the biggest edge? It was data, right? We don't have systems, so let's find data. Well, where do we start getting some data? In our submission flow. So what we did was we are putting software on the desks of our underwriters that ingest all the submissions they get. It then triages all of those submissions by whatever rules our underwriters want their inflowing business to look like. And so we're trying to order their submission flow into the one at the top is the one they're most likely to want to write, whatever that target zone is. It could be the submission is complete, or it could be that the software has read the submission file and has generated a electronic version of the submission, extracted all the data and said, hey, this one has no losses. So that goes to the top of the queue, right? It's essentially an ingestion and extraction tool that makes the underwriter focus on the accounts he wants to write and not necessarily ignore the ones he doesn't want to write.
Just prioritize them.
Prioritize it, because I find a lot of waste goes on in things like prioritization. Then we have a lot of administration once we prioritize stuff that I want to automate as part of the same process. Clearance, checking the broker record letter, right? Shrinking all the admin work and the support that goes into him or her making a decision. And so the software will do some clearance for us. Then what we are doing is on that pane of glass, we're throwing lots of other data that we don't have, but we can get from third parties. We throw that onto that screen to enrich the source of information the underwriter makes. So I could go on for hours about that, but that's, if you will, the first bookend. We get lots of data and we help our underwriters be smarter and attack the business they want initially, but we capture everything. And obviously there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes with all that information, but I'll save that for chapter two of the story. Now, what about the back end? What about the back end? Once I have that business on the books, what technology do I need in order to improve our business? And this is the thing that sort of you've heard all three of us have talked about throughout this podcast, which is claims, right? The industry is not very good at claims data. Now, let me give you my context. I believe the industry is a price taker in general, not a price maker, right? There's so much transparency and the brokers are so strong. It's very hard, and it can be done, but it's hard in general for me to dictate the price of the risk that I want and still clear the market because I've got competitors and et cetera, et cetera. So if I can't get the kind of maximum price I want, I've got to do other things to shape my return, my outcome on that business. Got to give the customer lots of great service. So they repeat, they become a repeat customer. I don't have the cost of renewing new business, right? That's a plus. I got to be able to make sure that I manage and sell them products that they want so they become a repeat customer. I've got to manage my capital dynamically. Those are all things I can do around the edges, but what's the big thing I can do? I can manage whatever claim experience I have in a much better way. And this is the part that really, as I think, the low-hanging fruit. I can ask 100 people, what is the cost of providing ULAE, unallocated loss adjustment expense, and allocated loss adjustment expense for an average claim, and I'll get 100 separate answers. Because no one really figures that out. It's a plug. When I did the total return reinsure in Bermuda, I called 10 buddies and asked them for what's the plug for loss in LAE, because everyone just plugs that number. And I think there's a lot of innovation around how you manage claims, particularly bad ones. So if I'm a price taker, what destroys my business? A bad claim outcome. Average claims are fine, right? Average claims experience are fine because the market prices to the average. What destroys me is a bad outcome. So I have to have really good process to manage the risk of a bad outcome. What's a bad outcome in our industry? I get whacked in court, right? I get a really, really bad claim. I go to court to defend it because I think I'm right. And I meet a jury that doesn't agree with me and awards 10 times my limit. That destroys my business. And by the way, there's technology that helps manage that risk. They're not, neither of these technologies are expensive. They're not hard to put in place. They provide massive amounts of data. I don't need to install an enterprise software system like Majesco or Guidewire. I don't need to rip up stuff that's already in place and replace it with stuff. I can put these in my operations without having to disrupt anything, and they immediately enrich my business. So you asked for how I think about innovation. To me, those are the two low-hanging fruits. At the front end with my underwriting tools, I'm better at risk selecting and hopefully not selecting the bad one that at the back end, when I have a claim, is the one that cleans me out in court. But I've got technology should that arise.
Yeah, that is probably the most succinct answer to that question that I have ever gotten on this show. So thank you for the clarity of thought. I love the clarity of thought around submission. I just took a bunch of notes on this just to chew on this later, but around prioritization of submissions because technology also has enabled people to submit to a lot more markets, right? So you end up with an increased volume of submissions in a hard market. Everybody's shopping more too. So as an underwriter, you've got to really prioritize the most likely thing you're going to write if you want to keep increasing your revenues.
You do.
You really do. And so, and on claims, I mean, I started 20 years ago starting with claims. And so I'm super sensitive to the claims argument. And I work for a few TPAs. And so I don't view that as a magic black box. I know how great and how terrible that can be, and have seen both. And certainly when I started building my own claim and policy software, Terra, I started on the claims end because I think it's like really where the opportunity is. You know, there's a lot of expensive policy software, but there's not a lot of really good claims software.
No, there isn't. And in my old company, before I worked here, our highest paid employees were claim adjusters, not underwriters. Our underwriters can only write the market clearing premium price. Our claims adjuster could save us $5 million. Why should we pay them more?
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, it's a great question. You may not agree with it, but if my underwriter can only underwrite the price that the market sets.
Yeah. To disagree with your statement would be disagreeing with logic, right? You're stating a logical point. Like you can only accept the market, right? You can write the market rate.
Now, what you can do, though, is you can make sure you don't pick a bad risk. So an underwriter has value. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
But the catalyst is he picks or she picks a bad risk, and then you have process error, which leverages your outcome, right? I mean, I write a $100,000 policy limit. I get ECO and XBL, which are fines and penalties. I get treble damages in court. Suddenly, my $100,000 limit that I priced to becomes a $5 million loss, right? That's what you need. You got to think that in the back of your mind as you set up your infrastructure for your business. How do I mitigate the bad things? I don't want to focus at the front end to capture. I don't want to only focus at the front end to capture as much premium as I can. I also want to focus on the consequences of picking bad customers. And if on average that choice leads to small marginal losses, I'm less concerning. But if the chance of a mistake is profound because my risk selection is bad and my process is bad, that makes my error totally different. And it comes back to, again, why I think I'm a bit of a unicorn, right? Because when I sit in my sessions with my colleagues, I try to make everybody sit back and go, yeah, I see where you're going. Maybe our focus should be to take that into account when we think about how do we underwrite and how do we set our rating rules? And what kind of information should we give our underwriter? Wow, litigation trends may be the most important data they use to underwrite. Let's make sure we get that to in our data set to our underwriters, right? More so than some other data that maybe they've spent 20 years relying on.
That's amazing. Rob, final question.
Yeah, David, I think this plays into something I know you've thought about, so I'd love to hear those thoughts, share it with our audience. So typically we measure, right, the productivity of our people, and we think about commissions, right, top line revenue growth, like rewarding sales, right? And like you said, we're focused on the premium side, and maybe we're not focused as much on the value of that, you know, outstanding underwriter from a risk selection standpoint, or particularly the claims adjusters you kind of mentioned, like, hey, maybe they should actually earn more than the underwriter. So how can we build a model where a dollar saved is as valued as a dollar earned, or we're even rewarding people that kind of figures out how to get increased operating leverage due to an innovative use of technology, for instance?
Yeah, I may be somewhat of a lone wolf in the industry in this regard, because over my career, when I've gone in and talked about this, when I've been interviewed for jobs or talked about startups, I get these blank stares from people, right? What do you mean the underwriter is not the most important person in the room? Or what do you mean we should have some other measure for the amount of return that you provide us, right? But if I'm the investor in the company, I don't really care whether the person who adds the most value to the business is the underwriter, right? Who's driving value? Whatever the value is, who's driving the most value? Is it the person who figures out what the total lifetime value of a customer is, but doesn't make the underwriting decisions and tells the underwriters to go and focus on that client base because you've got a captive group of clients that you can write products for? Is it the operating person who comes in and figures out how to double the premium per underwriter because they put in a workflow environment that increases the productivity of the underwriter? Is it the claims person who avoids a $10 million claim because he or she saw something or alerted somebody or made a convincing argument to settle the claim? Rob, I wish I had an answer. It's been a source of frustration for me, and it's been something that I think frankly has held our industry back, and it's held it back in one important area. It's attracting the next wave of really thoughtful, innovative types who can come into our industry and apply their expertise in areas other than underwriting, right? What's the big thing we have, right? We have trouble attracting really good talent to our industry. And there's 100 reasons why, but that's one example of stuff that we could figure out or do and bring people in who aren't maybe an underwriter. Maybe they're futurists. Maybe they look at Amazon as our next big competitor and try to figure out how to partner with Amazon rather than compete with the same guy they've been competing with for 20 years. I wish I had an answer, Rob. I don't. I think about it every day. I try to get our people to think that way and reward people who add value. And I don't care where the value comes from, right? It's value.
Excellent conversation. David, this has been great. And we are at time, but I really appreciate your insight, your thoughtfulness, and you have an interesting career that's led you to have certainly a lot of experience, and you were able to bring that to bear today. So I really appreciate it. I hope you stay warm for the holiday season, and thanks for joining the InsurTech Geek podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, my co-host, Rob Galbraith. Rob, thanks for being on today.
Yeah, always a pleasure, James. Thanks, David, for a great conversation.
And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in today to Geek Out, our interview with David Mocklow from MSIG North America. See you next time.
This has been the InsurTech Geek Podcast, powered by JB Knowledge, jbknowledge.com. The InsurTech Geek Podcast is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. I've been your host, James Benham, that's jamesbenham.com, with co-host Rob Galbraith at endofinsurance.com. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to meeting up again. We're taking you on a journey through InsurTech, so enjoy the ride and geek out.